I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
It's Talkin' Golf with Ann Liguori on The Fan. Sports Radio 101.9 FM and Sports Radio 66. WFAN and WFAN-FM, New York.
Well, welcome back to Talking Golf with Ann Liguori on this gorgeous Sunday morning. And if that music doesn't get you going, I don't know what will. Alex Lifeson, legendary guitarist for Rush, joins me now. Alex, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann. It's nice to be back.
It's good to talk with you, man. Just legendary guitarist. Such an honor, really. And, of course, golf connected us in the first place. We met at Robbie Krieger's tournament, Scotty Medlock's charity tournament,
right,
in
yeah.
California.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, still in touch with those guys all the time. Actually, I probably talk to Scotty once a month.
Oh, I love it. Scotty, yeah. what an artist, what a talent he is. I got to get Scotty on the show.
Yeah, but, very sweet guy, too.
You know, it's so refreshing to see how so many musicians have a passion for golf. You, Alice Cooper, Robbie, the late Glenn Frey, Kenny G, Justin Timberlake, Vince Gill.
Sure.
What about the game attracts the musician in you, Alex?
A lot of it has to do with just being engaged on the road. Being on the road, I mean, it seems like a glamorous thing, and it is very unique and interesting and fun, but it's also really... it's depressing at times, and you just feel like you're locked into your hotel room until you actually go to the gig. So golf became an escape for me, certainly. And some days I would play two rounds, have lunch in between, and make it a full day. And it just gets you out of your room and into an environment that's healthy and clear. You meet a lot of nice people, and you're outside swinging your club. You're getting some exercise. You're getting some sunshine. All of those things are really important when you're, trapped inside a hotel room.
So you would bring your clubs everywhere?
Oh, I bring my clubs everywhere, including up to my hotel room every night, and I would chip in the morning on the carpet, or I put a couple pillows up and hit some...
I love it.
One time, I forget where it was, there were a few of us, and we were sort of trapped. The weather was crappy. We pulled the mattresses off the beds and put them up against the window, and just, hit driver into these mattresses. So, I mean, low drivers, of course.
I love that image. I can just see you guys knocking these balls into mattresses. I'm sure the hotel loved that.
I don't think they ever quite found out about it. But
well, can you make any comparisons at all, like the technique of mastering the electric and acoustic guitar to the challenge of learning golf, maybe to hit a chip shot or an iron shot?
People say tempo is such an important thing, and they automatically assume that as a musician you have a better sense of tempo than say the layman. But I find that the things that work with me and don't work with me, my wrists tend to be quite supple from playing the way I play. And most guitarists are like that. So when I hold on a club, I'm a little too loose in my wrists, I feel. I'd like to have a better solid feel as I take the club back. Maybe I'm making that up as an excuse for my crappy shot, but that's something that I've kind of wondered about. Tempo is so important. You finish your swing with the right tempo. You make your turn, everything. If you're too fast, your arms go forward and you start casting and all of these things. But it's a really hard thing to do. Even when you have a normal sense of musical tempo, it's really hard to get that right kind of speed to the swing. And that's always a work in progress for me.
Well, it sounds like, you guys are all perfectionists as musicians. I mean, Rush was just a genius. And How does that carry over to your golf game? Do you feel like you're almost too much a perfectionist on the golf course?
Yeah, I would say sometimes it's a bit of a curse. Every shot has to be perfect. And I think a lot of golfers put this pressure on them. And it takes the fun out of the game. It becomes a little too serious. It's easy to get angry at yourself or at the game or at your ball or at your clubs, because it's always your ball or your clubs. It's never you. And it's just that kind of a crazy game that you just want to be perfect. You want to be as good as you can every round that you play. And once you start taking the pressure off, and I'm sure many golfers have found this, those rounds where you score really, really well usually are those rounds where you're not even thinking about what you're doing. You just kind of go out and play. You don't have any expectations. And, you know, you hit the ball great, and you score great, and you putt great. Everything's happening. So you know that it's inside you somewhere to pull out. Like the pros, they need to do that every time they play, every time they practice, every time they address a golf ball. They have to be perfect.
So. Was that cruise control similar to when you get in a zone like that on the golf course? Is that similar to perhaps how you were on stage?
Absolutely. There's a correlation there for sure. Your best nights are the nights where you're not even aware of your playing. You're looking at the crowd, and it's like your mind is floating. It's not like you're paying attention to something else. Your mind just kind of floats, and the only thing you're aware of is getting out of the way of what you're doing. And perhaps that's the way the pro golfers are, or any professional athlete operates. I mean, I watched Last Dance last week, and it was so fascinating to watch Michael Jordan. I forgot how amazing he was, how he could move and switch and in midair in a millisecond. It looks great, slow motion. It looks like it was all planned, but wow, to have that kind of skill and foresight and connection with your body and your head, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was like choreographed. It's just something of beauty, really.
Yeah, and certainly Tiger was that. So many great golfers have that ability.
Well, I know you taught yourself how to play guitar when you were 12. What about golf? When and how did you get started in golf?
I was a latecomer to golf. I mean, when we were kids, we played hockey a lot on the street. And I remember John, who was our original drummer, had his dad had some golf clubs. And we would take some of those clubs out and just knock a ball around every once in a while. And I caddied when I was 11 or so, at a local, I remember I got 75 cents and a Coke for for working the whole round. Geez, I lost the train of thought here.
Just when you started.
Yeah, so I started when I was 37. I was a very late bloomer. I didn't think golf was that interesting a game. I didn't really watch it. I'd watch the majors if I happened to be in front of a TV, but I was never really into golf. I was into a lot of other things. And then I went on my 37th birthday to a local driving range, and just on a whim, got a few buckets of balls and hit some balls. Oh, my God, I was addicted at that moment. My hands were bleeding. I came back the next day and bought a set of clubs at this public facility. A month later, I joined this big, fancy, schmancy golf club, and then I bought three sets of clubs, and then I never looked back after that. In fact, I guess it was 14 years ago, I got involved in Coppenwood, which is a Tom Fazio, the first Tom Fazio golf club here in Canada, as one of the members. There were as one of the owners, there were seven of us that put this the club together. We were dissatisfied with the club that we were at and thought, let's build our own place that's going to be amazing, and we won't have these complaints. And that's what we ended up doing.
I love that. Just build your own course.
Well, it was a little more complicated than that. And it's a great way to lose a lot of money fast.
Right.
That's what I really learned about it. But
I know Celine Dion told me, I had the opportunity to golf with her years ago for my show on the Golf Channel. And she and her husband, Rene, they bought Le Mirage in Montreal. Golf course, because they wanted their own private club. They didn't want to, wait for tea times.
So
they bought their own golf course.
Yeah.
But, you know, I really enjoyed watching the documentary on Rush, Beyond the Lighted Stage. You and Geddy Lee and Neil Peart all grew up in Canada from humble beginnings. And, you know, the amazing thing is you all stayed together for over 40 years. And that doesn't happen in the world of rock and roll too often.
Oh, that doesn't happen in the world, period.
Exactly.
You know, we, from the beginning, well, Geddy and I were friends from junior high school, and we had such a love of music. We would jam, you know, after school I'd go to his place or he'd come to mine, and we would jam for a couple hours almost every day. And it was a dream of any adolescent male to join a rock band and, you know, pick up chicks and this whole thing. But for us, the music was so important, and it was really about becoming a good musician and the best at what you do. And we started early with that, and that was the underlying reason for what we were doing. And when Neil joined the band, he was so skilled, even at that early stage, that it was inspiring to Geddy and me, and we just kind of moved as a unit. We also shared a very similar sense of humor. So the time that we spent together when we weren't focused on music was like being with your very best friends all the time. And then you got to travel and see this other world and live this experience that you only ever dreamed about. And you got to do it together with guys that you really loved. So it was a no-brainer, really, for us. We were really, really fortunate because I know lots of bands that imploded. The guys just couldn't stand each other after a while, or there was competition or jealousy over who wrote what song and who made what money and all of that stuff. We were always very democratic in the way we ran things. If it wasn't a unanimous decision doing something, we didn't do it. If there was a royalty payment because someone wrote something, the whole band shared in it. You know, that took out a lot of the stress and angst and the kind of jealousy and anger that can develop in some bands.
Sure. And I want to, you know, wish you condolences on the loss of Neil Peart, who fought a courageous battle with brain cancer for, what, over 3 years and passed away a couple of months ago. I mean, you guys played together for over 40 years. You all were like brothers.
Yeah, we were. We were beyond brothers. It was more like we were, you know, we'd been in a war together, and we had this connection that would, even when we didn't see each other for months, or, you know, it was like we just left, you know, the day before, and we picked it up where we left off. It was always like that with us, and we always stayed in touch. And I'm in touch with Geddy regularly. Before this whole COVID-19 pandemic situation happened, you know, Ged and I would see each other every week. We'd go for dinner, or at least talk to each other. It's been a little crazier now because of this whole thing and this adjustment that we've made these last few months, but we're still in touch, and we'll always have that friendship right to the end of our days.
I mean, do you miss performing? Do you think there's any chance that you and Geddy will do some concerts together?
I miss performing in its essence, get on stage playing, especially when you're really in good shape, you've rehearsed and you know everything, and you know, it's effortless. I do miss that aspect of it. I don't miss the touring. The only thing, the touring, that I miss is not playing golf every day in a different fantastic golf club. But the rest of it, you know, sitting in a hotel room, being away from my family, being away from friends, I mean, it's a price you pay. And when, in a whole scope of things, it's not that great a price for the return. But still, after 40 years of being away from your family, particularly, it becomes difficult. And after now, it's been almost 5 years since the last tour, I can't say that I really miss it at this point. Maybe a year or two after we stopped, I probably missed it more. But I've settled into it now, and I quite like my life and what I'm doing, and I keep active in music, and I, you know, I'm so in love with golf during the summer, and I'm close to my family. It's a very good balance for me.
Do you guys ever talk about maybe going back on stage?
Not really. I, you know, it's been difficult. You know, after Neil passed in January, I've played very little guitar. I don't feel inspired and motivated. It was the same thing when his daughter died in a car accident in 1997. I didn't really play for about a year, and I just don't feel it in my heart right now. Every time I pick up a guitar, I just aimlessly kind of mess around with it and put it down after 10 minutes. Normally, I would pick up the guitar and I would play for a couple of hours without even, you know, being aware that I'm spending that much time. So I know it'll come back. And I think Getty, working on his book for those couple of years, he was so involved in that book, which is, by the way, a fabulous book. When he finished it, he went on a tour for a year promoting it. You know, every time I spoke to him about getting back together, it was like, you know, yeah, when I get through this. And then always something comes up, I guess. And I don't know if the motivation is there for us to really do anything now. We're certainly proud of our track record, and we still love music, but it's different now.
Sure, I'm sure. Alex Lifeson, the legendary guitarist for Rush, joining me, passionate golfer, and you all had to have been aware of how deeply your lyrics connected to your fans, Alex. I mean, Rush was often referred to as the thinking man's band. What was the process like? I mean, did you have the melodies first, then put the lyrics to it, or vice versa, or what was it like?
Well, right from the beginning, when Neil joined the band, neither Getty or I really wanted to write lyrics. That was a huge, you know, obstacle for us. So we broached Neil about it. I mean, we could see that he was a reader. He read constantly on the road. When we first met him, he always had half a dozen books with him, and he just plowed through them. So we thought, you know, maybe he'd be interested in writing lyrics. And we asked him, and he said, you know, I hadn't thought of it, but yeah, I'll give it a whirl. And of course, it was a great decision. It took the pressure off us, certainly. And he became a great writer, not only of music lyrics, but of the books that he published as well. And I think he was a very, very intelligent guy, very thoughtful. He had a broad knowledge of a lot of things, and he had strong opinions. And when he started writing lyrics, I'd say that, you know, he wrote with, you know, metaphorically about, you know, placing things in the future in space or in the past, and that sword and sorcerer sort of thing until the kind of the late 70s. And then he started writing in a more observational mode, commenting on things around him, relationships, global issues, and things like that. And he wrote it in such a way that I think readers could really grasp his meaning, but at the same time develop their own ideas about what the songs mean. And that was a great thing for any fan, because then they have their own interpretation of what the song means to them. And at the end of the day, that's what the important thing is. You can have your own idea of what it is, but if someone has their idea of what the meaning is and they hold it true to their heart, you know, then that's a very personal thing. We, Getty and I, always were focused on the music, so we always wrote the music, and Neil always wrote the lyrics. That gave us a three-way division in the songwriting as well, and it made it easy for us to be fair about how we were processing, you know, the publishing end of the songs that we were writing.
What a winning combination, really. You all were so fearless, which is, you know, which I think was a key. So back to golf, when you play golf, you know, you have to be really relaxed and mellow, right? But when you guys were on stage, you had so much intensity. Every night, it was like, you know, having the intensity of a game seven, right? So how difficult is it for you to transform from that onstage personality that you brought all the time to, like, that calm and cool persona that you really have to be a good golfer?
Yeah, there are similarities. I think before a show, you arrive at the gig, there's a sound check at 4:30 till 6 o'clock, and then there's sort of that dead period from 6 o'clock or 6:30 till showtime, which was usually around 7:30. So you had an hour to just sit back, and quite often we would read or get on your iPad, or always a half hour before the show, I would warm up. We'd all actually have our own rooms and warm up before the show for a good half hour before. Walking down the hallway up to the stage set the tone, really, for the way you needed to feel emotionally before going on stage. And that walk was always just exactly that. I had my in-ears, in my ears, my monitors, so I couldn't hear anything around me. My pack was not turned up yet. So it was a quiet walk to the stage. And that, I think, it just got your heart rate down. It made you kind of more settled into what was coming. Because the next 3 hours, it was all about intense concentration. A lot of times you don't notice the audience. You're so, so involved in the concentration of playing those crazy songs. And there are a lot of notes in Rush songs.
Right.
And you want to play them in the right sequence and efficiently. So it became, that was the most tiring thing, I think, of performing live. It wasn't the physical part of it. It was more the mental drain. And you came off stage really exhausted in that way, particularly if you had a really, really good night. Or sometimes, even if it wasn't a very good night, that made it even more difficult.
Right. So I can't imagine like how you turn that off when you're playing golf just to be calm and cool. But gosh, Alex, I could talk with you for hours, but we're out of time. So
okay.
Thank you so much, Alex Lifeson of Rush. Hit 'em straight and keep playing, man. It's great to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure, and thank you.
Thanks so much. What an honor to talk with legendary guitarist Alex Lifeson of Rush, Hall of Famer, pilot, artist, golfer. My thanks to Alex. My thanks to Mike Nichols, Chief Business Officer of the Symetra Tour, to Ed Arzuman in the studio. Talking Golf is brought to you by Travelers Insurance for auto, home, and business. Travelers, it's better under the umbrella. Stay well, stay positive, stay safe, and I will talk to you next Sunday morning right here on Talking Golf with Ann LaGorrie.